Welcome to Into the Colaverse, a podcast that takes us on the unique journeys of faculty in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. Join me, your host, Frederick Luis Aldama, as we learn of the many ways that our faculty and their cutting-edge work is transforming the world today. It is my absolute pleasure and honor to be with David Yeager, Associate Professor of Psychology and co-author of dozens of articles in the top journals, PI with Dr. Carol Dweck, Stanford University of UT's National Study of Learning Mindsets. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me.
I don't even know where to start with my kind of questions. I mean, you have such an incredible experience and a very interesting journey. You were a K through 8 school teacher in Tulsa, Oklahoma, at the same time that you were also, you know, finishing BAs, MAs, or MEDs at University of Notre Dame, and then went on to Stanford to get a master's and a PhD. Just incredible. And also the focus of your research is absolutely for all of us parents, for all of us who have teens in our lives, children coming up to become teens. So absolutely extraordinarily important. Let's start with the big question, kind of why did you get into social cognitive behavioral questions, teens, and all the things that teens go through, depression, stress, bullying, academic underperformance. Tell us how you got here with your journey to this place.
Yeah. Thanks for asking. So, it really came from my work, as a teacher, and I started out, just really feeling like our kids need us to be a lot better than we are at interacting with them. And the guidance that we got often in being trained to be teachers wasn't very good or scientific. And I just remember being a teacher sitting in the back of the room at a professional development workshop. And I look around and all of the best teachers were grading their papers and not listening. And I'm like, this is a sign maybe that the people who know what they're doing and know how to spend their time are feeling like this is a waste of their time. And eventually when it came time for me to decide whether I was going to stay in the classroom or try something else, I realized I wanted to be the person who did the research that ended up in the actually useful and like not worthless professional development training programs. And so I kind of had a pivot. I was thinking about going to law school for a while and realized that's not really how I wanted to spend years of my life getting good at something. If I was going to get good at something, I wanted to be more directly related to my interest in helping young people. And so I kind of pivoted to apply to graduate schools and was lucky to get in. And then I just kind of been off to the races ever since. And it's been really fun journey for me doing the work we do on teenagers and motivating them and helping to help them to meet their goals. And it's really the impact that sustains us in a lot of ways.
David, what for people maybe outside of your field, what is the behavioral side of psychology? What is this cognitive side? And then how does your work kind of wed these or bring the insights and advances together to help you answer some of the questions that you have?
Yeah. So I think the major thing is that we often look at like student underperformance, right? Like students who maybe try hard but then fail in our large gateway classes, for instance, whether it's freshman algebra one in high school or whether it's chemistry or physics or calculus in college. And we tend to attribute their lack of success to things about them, like a lack of ability or to their background. So maybe their high school wasn't any good, or maybe their parents didn't really motivate them. And we kind of end up making attributions that are about the kind of person they are and the traits that they have. And it's a kind of deficit thinking that pervades so much of our policy and so much of our programming. It's like we locate problems in the flaws of individuals, and then we try to either fix flawed people or keep flawed people out. Those are the dominant policy approaches when you have a trait-based view of deficiencies, right? The social cognitive perspective is different. We say, look, a lot of underperformance comes from the different interpretations and meanings that people make out of their experiences. In the exact same objective experience, whether it's getting critiqued by a teacher or being left out by a friend or just getting a score that's lower than what you wanted, can be portrayed to yourself in a totally different way depending on the cues that you perceive in your environment. And so we tend to focus on those subjective meanings. So if you're a high schooler taking Algebra 1 and the problem is you're having a hard time factor trinomials, we say, well, what does it mean to you that that's hard to you? And if it means to you that you're dumb in math and you're not a math person, then what if we could get you to have it mean something different? Like that you just haven't mastered it yet and haven't gotten enough support. If you're bullied by other kids in middle school, what does that mean to you? If it means to you that you're a loser and you'll never have friends and these bullies are terrible people, then you want to like take revenge or you feel ashamed, right? You want to hide it. You don't problem solve. But if it means to you that other people are misguided and have this terrible way of seeking status that they need to get out of, then you might be angry, but you don't, you're not filled with rage and hatred and you don't want to take revenge. You don't feel as ashamed, and on and on and on. So the whole point behind the cognitive side is to really take us out of a world where we're trying to blame and judge individuals for having flawed traits and into a world where we take seriously what it means to someone else when they're going through a hard time and try to figure out how we can help them reframe everyday experiences so that they can really kind of unlock their motivation and potential.
David, you've done some really fascinating research on entity theory of personality and also on incremental theory of personality. For say the lay listener, person hearing our podcast right now, what exactly is that and how does that play into a kind of mindset model that you're developing?
Yeah, so those are entity and incremental labels are the kind of inside baseball terms for fixed mindset and growth mindset. So they're really interchangeable. Fixed mindset is the idea that you are a certain way and there's nothing you can do to change it, or that other people are a certain way. There's nothing you can do to change it. So their morality, their intelligence, their personality, those are fixed traits they can't change. The growth mindset is the idea that people can develop those qualities, that they can grow incrementally, which is why we call it incremental theory. And that's your own personal lay theory or mindset about growth and the potential for change. And the reason this matters is because if you think about the origins of despair and hopelessness, they're really rooted in the belief that things can never get better, right? And what is the origin of hope, right? It's the belief that it's plausible and possible for things to improve. So what we try to do in a lot of our studies is give people a good reason to believe in the possibility of change. And then that inspires them to go out and look for evidence that that might be true. And so we kind of embolden people to have a sense of hope and actually cultivate a sense of hope when they're going through a hard time.
And in fact, also on the teacher side of things as well, right? I mean, after all, we started this conversation talking about, you know, teachers checking out because they weren't being given productive, say, models for understanding how to be in the classroom in ways that, you know, change student mindsets. I mean, from the teacher side of things, tell me, what you've been able to share with, you know, education audiences.
Yeah. So for a long time, we were interested in changing kids' mindsets. So telling them, hey, if you feel like science is hard, for instance, it doesn't mean you're dumb at science. It means you're growing your science brain while you're being challenged, right? And we found that that was good for kids in a lot of ways. So in our large randomized trial conducted with a national sample of schools, we found that even a less than 45-minute exposure to this growth mindset idea through the internet, they did it on their own, could improve their grades, especially in math and science, at the end of the year. However, kids only profited from that treatment that they got when their teachers also reinforced the growth mindset idea. If the kids got a growth mindset, but in a classroom where a teacher said, basically, look to your left, look to your right, half of you aren't smart enough to do well, then the teachers squashed the growth mindset effect. And we're now finding, even 4 years later, treatment effects from a short intervention at the beginning of ninth grade on whether kids are graduating from high school ready for college. 4 years later, but only in schools that had cultures that continued to support growth mindset thinking. If the school culture made you feel like embarrassed or ashamed for asking for more challenges or for trying harder in school, then you don't see the long-lasting effects. So that has pushed us to thinking about teachers as an agent for change in school culture. What are all the subtle ways that teachers communicate to students that some of them are smart enough to do well and others aren't? Or by contrast, that everyone has the potential to learn and improve if they put in the work and if they are willing to revise and so on. So I think our newest work is really focused on the mindset of the teacher and how they create a culture that emboldens all students to feel safe and included in the journey of learning.
David, you have a book proposal called The Mentor Mindset. Is there some additional nuances, some other areas? Does it expand to, say, us parents?
Yeah. So I think what's happened is for a long time, we thought, let's just teach teachers to have a growth mindset, and then they'll create a growth mindset culture. And we're learning it's a little more complicated. So that's led me to think of this idea of a mentor mindset. And what's nice about a mentor is that they hold you to high standards. They're tough, right? They're not a pushover, but it's clear that they're there to help you achieve your goals. They're aligning themselves and their actions with your goals. And so a good teacher creates this mentoring relationship with the student. And it's a combination of high standards and high support. It turns out, however, that the best managers do the same, and the best parents do the same, and the best coaches do the same. And there's this kind of magical combination of rigorous standards and highly supportive relationships that helps young people thrive. And so we've been doing things like working with Microsoft to say, okay, you have something like 20,000 managers at Microsoft. So who are the top 50 that create a mentor relationship with people, and how do you elevate them? And how do you find out what they're saying, what they're doing? I found this woman who's a parenting coach. So if money is no object to you, you have all the money in the world as a parent, who's the person you hire as your parenting coach to come in your home and like watch what you do? And so I found her and I'm talking to her, and it's really interesting. I'm learning a lot. And I'm also finding exceptional educators. So who is the teacher who creates the most equitable outcomes across the state of Texas? And his name is Sergio Estrada, and he teaches at Riverside High School. And it's like, he can see the Juarez River right there. That's why it's called Riverside. And at a school where 2% of his kids are college ready, according to the SATs, 95% pass college physics, right? So I talk to Sergio every Friday. And it's just incredible to see the commonalities between the best managers, the best parents, parenting coaches, and the best teachers. And they all have this mentoring approach of high standards plus high support.
David, how does this, move our understanding into areas that we can also help youngsters improve, say, or get more of, let's maybe sleep, coping mechanisms, just day-to-day issues that they constantly face, including, of course, this omnipresent social media stuff that we have to deal with?
Yeah. Social media is really tricky not to crack. And I would say that the evidence is really mixed. So on the one hand, it can cause a lot of harm. And so we've done some studies where we had hundreds of teenagers join in a social media platform that we developed. And then we've randomly assigned them to, over the course of an experiment, so this wasn't out in the wild, randomly assigned them to either get the second fewest likes out of a group of 12 or the second most likes out of a group of 12. And so no one got dislikes, no one got bullied, no one got made fun of, but some people were the bottom rank for likes and other people were the top. And we find that this has a huge effect. Kids are about twice as likely to say they don't like themselves if they got fewer likes. And it the extent to which they don't like themselves when they get few likes predicts onset of depression over the first year of high school. So really important effects. So on the one hand, there's a big risk from this world where you are constantly comparing yourself to others. And again, it goes back to meaning making. You're saying to yourself, like, I objectively just got liked by 100 people, but my friends got liked by 1,000 people, so I'm less than them. So your main takeaway, the meaning you make out of it, is I'm less than other people, right? And that's, but there are different ways to tell yourself a story about the same experience. So how can you encourage positive appraisals or positive meaning making about social media? That's like a really hard nut to crack. The one we're focused on right now is stress and anxiety. And the particular angle we take on it is the idea that it feels like everything is impossible right now. It feels like you're being asked to do more than anyone can do, and you're not being given any more resources. And you have to do it faster than ever, and the stakes are higher than ever. So it's a kind of race to nowhere, they call it. So what's the advice that adults tend to give to teenagers in that circumstance? And the answer is pretty terrible advice. Normally what people say is basically they get you to disengage from your stressors. So it'd be like, go do yoga, go drink chamomile tea, go like meditate. And those are perfectly fine and good things to do. But if you are racing to get your college applications in, or if you're preparing a presentation for your boss, or if you're like about to have the most important state championship match for whatever activity you're doing, that's not the time to take a nap and like drink chamomile tea. Like, you need to be on top of your game at those points. So this message of like, run away from your stress is often wrong when you're talking about the very real demands that are placed on young people for performance. So we've instead said, well, what if you could learn to embrace your stress and worry and anxiety and use it as a resource? Now, there are certain times when you're totally like in lizard brain mode and you're totally anxious, like hyperventilating. That's not the time to do this message I'm telling you about. But those are rare times. Most of the time, we just feel like always on. And there's a way to start embracing the racing heart and the sweaty palms and the heavy breathing as a means for preparing your body for optimal performance. And it's by realizing that the way the brain gets smarter is by having more oxygen going to the neurons. The way your muscles get stronger is by having more oxygen to the muscle fibers. And the way it does that is by breathing more, pumping more blood more quickly. And the sweat cools your body down so that you have cooler blood going to your brain and your muscles. And so we have people reappraise make different meaning out of their body's physiological stress experiences. And in a new paper that's coming out in Nature, we show that that helps teenagers deal with a lot of stressors, including even the stress of being isolated during COVID-19.
Boy, yeah, we need all of that research that you're doing, and we need it in accessible forms in the way that you're doing. David, as we wind this down here, what are you reading? What's on your proverbial nightstand that's exciting and interesting for you. And that could be fiction, nonfiction, anything really.
Yeah. Well, I'm all, I always try to read the latest Walter Isaac biographies. So like the Ben Franklin one is my favorite one. And so I'm reading the Jennifer Doudna one now, which I like a lot. Because I like to see where the science comes from and how people developed the ideas and so on. But I'm also just reading a ton, as I have been for several years, about just our nation's history of systemic inequalities and where they come from and how they constrain opportunities for people. Because I think the next continued evolution of our work is going to need for it to be into contact with the kind of long-standing inequities that make it hard for people, even when sufficiently motivated, and even when they're coping with stress, to overcome barriers to inequality. So The Color of Law is a good one. It's just the history of redlining and other policies like that in our country. And a few other books like that, I think, are just continuing my evolution and thinking about systems that perpetuate inequalities. And then what I want to find is, where is there leverage in human behavior where maybe the agents who constrain opportunities, whether it's teachers or managers or police officers or principals or other actors in the institutional level, where we might be able to shift their behaviors to make systems more fair and equal.
So powerful. Absolutely. And so all of your work, all your research, all your findings having a direct impact in and through policymaking. But I love that, you know, the readings, the active reading that you're doing, it's constantly keeping you on your toes in terms of your framing questions. That's so important. Absolutely so important. David, you also like karaoke. Tell us about karaoke. I know it's mentioned, you mentioned this along with, you know, your students and being an active role model for your students. But yeah, as we end this, karaoke.
Yeah, no, I think I'm a pretty big fan of high fives and karaoke. The nice thing about karaoke, if you do it right, is it's not about looking better than others. You're being discovered or anything like that. It's about like being vulnerable with friends. And I think we have so few spaces these days where you can be publicly vulnerable. I mean, even social media, which started out as a place for your non-professional self to let your hair down, now it has to be perfectly curated because it's evaluated by so many others. And so I think the right room for karaoke with the right vibe is one of the last safe places to just be a goofball in front of people and not worry about like being a scandal or like feeling excluded. Like you could just sing Sweet Caroline and just, you could, I don't know, like it's just great. So I'm not a good, particularly good singer or dancer, but my favorite activity is to create very inclusive karaoke spaces for people who wouldn't normally be publicly vulnerable in front of others. And I don't mind a little Libertad Lamarque or La Dama del Tango is one of my favorites. So I have a few favorites that I like to throw in there too.
David, thank you so much for all the work that you do. Asking the right questions, designing experiments, creating solutions, interventions, opening pathways for our, you know, new generations, but also for us as parents, for us as teachers, coaches, all of us. And finally, I look forward to your book, The Mentor Mindset. I can't wait for that. Thank you, David.
Great. Thank you so much.
Into the Colaverse is produced by the University of Texas at Austin's College of Liberal Arts. Sound engineering by the Liberal Arts Instructional Technology Services. You can find Into the Colaverse podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.